You're listening to the School Success Formula with me, Lucy Parsons. This is episode number 46. Hello and welcome to today's show. I'm so pleased that you're here. So on today's show, I've got a fantastic guest for you all the way from Texas in the USA, who is Lisa Van Gemert, and she is going to be talking to us about perfectionism and how it can be an impediment to doing your very best in your schoolwork and exams, and how to overcome perfectionism. And she's going to share with us some amazing tools that will really help you to help your child to overcome perfectionism. Before we dive into today's interview though, I just want to let you know that on Friday the 4th of May at 7 p.m. in the evening, I'm going to be running a Year 10 revision workshop. So if you've got a child in Year 10 who is taking end of year exams and could really do with some help and support to boost their confidence in their ability to revise and to really approach their exams in a really positive way, then this is the workshop for you and them. So I think it's really important to get your child into really good study habits and study skills before they start in year 11. Lots of parents don't want to put pressure on their children to do this kind of thing before they get into year 11. They think that year 11, their children will hit the ground running and they'll be able to do the good work all the way through. But I actually think it's more supportive to get them into those good habits and start getting them to think positively about how to revise and about how to schedule revision and how to make it work for them a little bit earlier than this, because I find that a lot of families and students who leave it too late become really quite overwhelmed by it all in year 11, and year 11 goes frighteningly fast once it begins. So I really hope you'll consider coming along to this workshop. If you can't make it live, as ever, I will email out a recording to the people who have signed up, but you will need to sign up in advance if you want to have access to the workshop. The last workshop I did about exam technique, I had people begging me afterwards if they could get access to the recording, but it's out of integrity for me to say, you know, you have to sign up beforehand if you want this workshop, and then to be selling it to people afterwards. So if you want to be part of it, then please do sign up beforehand. So you'll find the information page and all the links to sign up on my website, and you can find that at lifemoreextraordinary.com/year-10, that's 10, revision workshop, or there will also be a link from today's show notes, which you'll find at lifemoreextraordinary.com/46. Okay, let's go over to today's interview. Using a combination of neuropsychology, pedagogy, experience, humour and technology and sheer fun, our guest today shares best practices in education with audiences around the world. She is an expert consult to television shows, including Lifetime's Child Genius, and a writer of award-winning lesson plans, as well as numerous published articles on social psychology and pedagogy, and the book Perfectionism: Practical Strategies for Managing Never Good Enough. A former teacher, school administrator, and youth and education ambassador for Mensa, she shares resources for educators and parents on her website, giftedguru.com, and is co-founder with Ian Bird of the Gifted Guild, a professional community for educators of the gifted. She and her husband are the parents of three sons and live in Arlington, Texas. Welcome to the School Success Formula, Lisa Van Gemert.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here and to speak with you and share with your listeners.
Oh, it's so amazing to have you here from the other side of the world. So, Lisa, first of all, can you tell us, you've come on the show today to talk about perfectionism. Can you first tell us how you got interested in this area of education?
Well, I got interested in perfectionism very organically because I was a perfectionist when I was growing up, even as a very young child. In fact, just this morning, I was sorting through some old family pictures that I inherited when my grandmother died. And I found a picture of myself when I was maybe 13. And I was standing next to another girl and we had been swimming and we're both in our bathing suits. And just the way that I'm standing, I'm like trying to block my body because I didn't think it was perfect. And I was the same height I am now and weighed, I don't know, 2 stone less. You know, I was just so worried about everything being perfect, even when I was really young. I can remember struggling with things when I was 4 and 5 years old.
So it's something you've seen in yourself, but kind of in your professional career as a teacher and all that kind of thing.
As I work with gifted children and even more typical learners, what I find is that so many of them are struggling with not just perfectionism as like a whole overarching and all-consuming dynamic, but just small elements of perfectionism that get in the way of assignments and college applications and driving and letters to thank grandma and every little aspect of their life. So if you work with youth at all, you're going to see it.
Okay. And I know that you have this special interest in it, what you call the gifted segment of the youth population. Is it something that you particularly see amongst those children, or is it in the entire young population?
So anybody can have perfectionism or perfectionistic tendencies. If you're looking at high ability people, they're going to have it. In my experience, they have it at a higher rate than the general population, which makes sense, right? Like if you recognize that within yourself you have high ability, mm-hmm. there is a natural inclination to set very high standards for oneself. Also, it's likely that your peer group is high achieving. So then you have this comparison thing going on, this comparison dynamic going on. Then you also have the added impact and influence now of social media, which is so aspirational. So that people are putting things on social media that make you feel as though you should be a certain way. And so although I focus on the gifted in my educational practice, this book is for anyone. And I think that unfortunately it's becoming more and more necessary of a topic to discuss.
Okay, so I've got a question now. How do you know if you're a perfectionist?
Well, what I say is that the way I define perfectionism is that it is unreasonably high standards combined with a lack of self-love. And so what will happen then, you can tell if you're a perfectionist if you set a standard for yourself that really, if you're honest with yourself, you know isn't reasonable, and then you get angry, frustrated, disgusted with yourself, and you feel useless and worthless if you don't make that. So if you have high standards and you frequently are feeling frustrated and disgusted with your efforts, then you're gonna have to wear the banner. Now, I will say that people can be perfectionistic in different areas of their lives, right? So the same kid whose backpack looked like, you know, Armageddon can have a real strong desire to never get less than the highest of grades. So perfectionism, or to say that someone is a perfectionist, is really far more broad than we need to worry about. What we would look at is, does someone have standards so high for themselves that it's causing them pain?
Yeah.
Even if it's not in all areas of their life. So we don't have to say, oh, he's a perfectionist or she's a perfectionist. We can say that he or she has perfectionistic tendencies, using it more as an adjective than a noun, like not a full identity, but definitely aspects of their life. So if you're in pain because you can't meet the expectations you set for yourself, then that's who I wrote the book for.
That's a really interesting definition, and I'd never thought of it like that before. You know, that it, perfectionism is such a problem that it's causing you pain. It's like, as a student at school myself, I pushed myself to be really, really, really good, but I never pushed myself to the point where it was actually destructive. And so that's the distinction.
That's the distinction, because for people with high ability or actually any level of ability, if you're setting very high standards for yourself, but you have the ability to meet those standards. Mm-hmm. And if you somehow fall short, you can forgive yourself mm-hmm. and see it as a learning opportunity, then very high standards are fine.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want to have neurosurgeons who are like, well, I'm a little bit worried about the psychic pain I might cause myself from too high of standards. So I'm just going to hope that I do kind of a good job every time I crack open someone's skull. No, very high standards are fine as long as you do have the toolbox to make that happen. And if something does go wrong, you recognize that nobody expected you to be perfect.
Yeah, I was talking about this the other day with my husband. We were talking about the 80-20 rule. Is it called the Pareto principle? And I was saying, oh no, it's a really good idea. You know, it makes you focus in on the things that really make the difference and all this kind of thing. And he's a mathematician and he works with data all day long. And he was like, no, everything has to be 100% right. Otherwise, nothing adds up. And I was like, okay, I can see that in the context of a spreadsheet, that 100% precision is important. But there are other areas of life where you can be a little bit more forgiving. So,
yeah, that's the key, right? Is that recognizing that certain areas of our lives need more perfection than others. In the book, I talk about if a child has diabetes and needs to be on insulin, we want them perfect in checking that blood sugar and in following the diet and doing the things that they need to do to stay healthy. I mean, their life is at stake. Mm-hmm. So at the same time, if a child has a journal writing habit that's important to them, missing a day in writing in your journal has nowhere near the ramifications or implications that skipping a day of insulin would.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's really good to put that in context, isn't it? So when I first came across you, I was listening to a podcast interview you were doing with somebody else, and you were talking there about how perfectionism can actually stop people in their tracks and stop them from achieving at all, which I think some people would find quite unexpected. I think most people would expect to see perfectionism manifesting as really, really high achievement consistently. So can you talk to us a little bit about some of the unexpected ways that perfectionism shows itself?
Sure. And underachievement is probably the number one most obvious. So the word that I would associate with that is discouragement. Because when you set a very high standard for yourself that you cannot meet, and then you realize you can't meet it, often you become so discouraged, or people who struggle with this become so discouraged that they just disengage from the thing altogether. Mm. And we can all understand that, because we've all had maybe not even a standard that we've set for ourselves, but maybe a standard that others have set for us mm-hmm. that we realize, oh, I can't do that. So I'm just not even going to play the game. I know I can't win, so I don't even want to play. And we've all probably been playing, like, even literally a game, like a board game with our family, and trying to keep the motivation to continue to play when you know you have no hope of winning, right? We've all wanted to disengage from those games.
Yeah.
And so what happens in perfectionism is that when people set this very high standard for themselves and they don't see success as anything less than perfect, right? Mm-hmm. That in order to be successful, I have to be perfect. And then they come to the realization, oh, wait, I'm not perfect. And that's not even one of the options. Then I don't even want to play at all. So in students, you see this in their work. So they have this idea in their mind of what they want to do. Like a teacher gives an assignment for some kind of project, and in their mind, they know, they can see what it looks like. They know, and they can envision turning it in, and the teacher is just like so excited and is going to use it as the example for years to come. But then when they go to actually do it, when they go to execute the project, they can't make it look anything like that. And so then sometimes people who struggle with this will just not even turn it in at all.
I've heard a lot of students, they come to me when they read my blog and they've said to me, I'm just so scared of failure that I can't even make myself get started. And I've realized in the work that I've been doing for the last 3 years that fear of failure is such a huge thing in stopping people. And it seems so counterintuitive that, you know, you would be so scared to fail. It's so important. You're so scared to fail that you won't even try. But so many students do it, don't they?
Yes. And I would say two things about that. The first is that that's a particular form of perfectionism called risk avoidance.
Okay.
Where if I don't think I can do it perfectly, I don't even want to try. The second thing I would say about that is that we're kind of used to that. We all do that to at least a certain extent. Imagine that you've taken a test and you're waiting for the results, or you've applied to a bunch of colleges and you're waiting to hear back, or you've applied for a promotion at work. I mean, this applies in all domains. You want something. You're waiting for test results of some kind. You want an outcome. And a lot of times we tell ourselves a different story. We'll tell other people too, as a cushion against disappointment. We'll say, oh, I know I didn't pass, or I know I didn't get in. So that then if we do get in, it feels like good news. And if we didn't get in, we're not embarrassed. So it's very common to have that risk avoidance in anybody. Perfectionists just take it a step further and say, well, I'm not even going to submit the test. I'm not even going to apply. I'm not even, right? I'm going to go one step back from even trying to hedge my bet.
Yeah, no, it's really destructive when you put it like that, and you hear about the extremes that perfectionists will go to avoid performance, really. Yeah, so what can parents do to help their children manage perfectionism and get out of their own way?
So that the entire book is full of suggestions in different aspects of perfectionism, but I'll share a few with you, and especially because I'm choosing the ones I'm going to share with you based on who I know is your kind of clientele and the people who are interested in the work that you're doing, because they're going to have specific things. The first I would say for parents is do a little bit of soul searching yourself to see, is perfectionism manifesting itself in your life? Now, you may not feel like a perfectionist. You may not feel that your expectations of yourself are unreasonable, or the expectations that you have of your children are unreasonable. And yet, oftentimes we're more perfectionistic than we think, not because it's the best of intention, right? Like, parents want their children to be successful so that they can be happy and have a wonderful life. And so oftentimes, and we believe so strongly in our children, that a lot of times what we feel like is belief in our children and encouragement comes across to them as pressure. Mm. And my husband to this day, he still talks about how he did not like to hear his mother bragging about things he did to other people. He felt tremendous pressure from that. And I think that we have to be careful as parents to follow the same thing as doctors do, which is first do no harm, right? Before you try to help your child, first make sure you're not doing any harm. Are there things that you're saying to yourself, even silent conversations that you're having with yourself? Are there things that you are saying either in action or in speech to your children that are kind of counterproductive to this? Or are there things that your child may be overhearing you say to your partner or spouse or to teachers or other parents or grandparents? So just making sure that you clean the environment, almost like if you were going on a diet and they tell you to clean all the garbage out of your kitchen, better cleaning all the perfectionism out of the home.
That's a really good tip. And I do occasionally get parents saying to me, you know, I'm worried that I'm judging. This is particularly happens with mothers talking about their sons and saying, I'm worried that I'm judging my son by my own standards and my own behavior. So like, I was a very bookish and studious student myself, and my son is not living up to the mark, and I know I've got to rein myself in, but I don't quite know how. I suppose, have you got any tips for parents about how they can do that?
So that's fear, Mm-hmm. Right? That's all fear-based.
Mm-hmm.
When parents have that, it's fear that their child will not be, typically the core of that fear is happiness. Like, we're worried their child won't be happy. And the reason we think they won't be happy is because they won't be successful. Like, and the reason we think they won't be successful is that they're not following the path that we followed to get the kind of success we think will help them. So we never missed turning in an assignment. We always took the most challenging classes. It never would have occurred to us not to study. It never would have occurred to us to give it what my grandma calls a lick and a promise, you know, just not really the effort. And so we think that the end of that road is, you know, living in the basement playing video games when you're 36 years old, mm-hmm. if you don't do those things. So what parents, the first step in avoiding that dynamic is to be truly self-reflective about what it is that you want for your child. Really envision what your child's future would look like if it were up to you. And then decide, are those expectations reasonable? Like, if your expectation of what you would like your child's life to look like is happiness and strong relationships with people and the ability to support him or herself, then that's reasonable. But if your expectations are that he's going to do, you know, I'm not as familiar with the British education system, although my husband is Australian, and so it's very similar there. But that he's going to get, you know, is it O-levels that are the higher ones?
And no, A-levels are the higher ones. GCSEs are the ones they take at 16, yeah.
Okay, so that A-level, you're going to get like as many as possible, that you're going to get accepted to the very best, like that Oxford and Cambridge are both going to be fighting over your child, one pulling one arm and one the other, and that the child is going to win a Nobel Prize and cure cancer, right? Like, if you're, and that's hyperbole, but most parents' dreams come somewhere in between. But if your dreams for your child are prescriptive, meaning that there's a path that it must be taken in order to achieve that dream, then you have got to recalibrate that and consider that happiness comes in all forms, and that success, however you define success, is a value judgment, and your child may not buy into that value.
I think the thing that I kind of think you missed there was actually knowing your child and knowing, and I personally am in the situation, I've got an 8-year-old daughter and I think she's bright and I can see, and lots of people tell me she is as well. It's not just what I think. And I like, how much does the knowledge of the child temper your aspirations for them?
Well, I think that it's a huge part of it, because we see our children and we believe we know what they're capable of. My dad says expectations are nothing more than preconceived resentments.
So that's heavy.
When you have an expectation of your child based on what you know your child is capable of, because you know your child, then you're setting yourself up for disappointment, and mm-hmm. you're setting yourself up for some real contention between you and your child. And it's very hard not to have expectations for your child. I doubt he'll hear this, and so I'll go ahead and out one of my own children. I have a son, probably my highest ability son, definitely the one with the highest IQ of all my children. And in college, he just could not make himself finish this one class. So he graduated 2 years ago, like he walked the stage and everything, and they gave him the fake diploma that you're supposed to come back and get. And he got hired at a job and he started working at that job and he makes twice as much money as I do. And he never has finished that class. And he has to keep paying a fee to like re-enroll it and extend, but he's paying it, so I don't care. And it is the most frustrating thing in the world to me, because he could finish that class if he's like, he only has one test left. He could knock it out tomorrow. But I have to just step back and say, all right, like, you are in charge of your own life. And so, you know, you're 25 years old now. So if you're never going to pull it out, you're never going to pull it out. And when children are younger, it's not something so global, but it's a homework assignment.
Yeah.
And it's taking a challenging class. And one of the things with highly able children is that they could do almost anything. You look at your child and you know, oh, this child could do this and that and this and that and this and that. And so by definition, they're not going to be able to be amazing in all of those areas.
No.
And so we have to rein in our own expectations and realize that as a child gets older, that they have a right to some self-determination. They have a right to choose some things for themselves, even if we know that that isn't necessarily the path to happiness or anything, that our children deserve the same thing that we want for ourselves, which is the right to make our own choices, even if they don't end up being necessarily what was best for us in the end.
Yeah, and I suppose that coincides with what you said at the beginning about values, and it's not just ability, but the ability has to combine with the values that the child has to make them the person that they're going to be.
Yes, I just recently read a book on underachievement in the gifted, and it said that the person writing it was a teacher who had had a student who had a lot of ability who ended up going into the military, and the author of the book was criticizing that, saying, oh, that's definitely underachievement. And I thought, that's such a value judgment, because today's military is so highly technological that there are a lot of very intelligent people there operating these very sophisticated computer systems, and they're economists and mathematicians and everything. So we have to decide, what does that even look like to ourselves? The person who tunes my piano is in Mensa, and she's a genius. And she said, this is what I love. And I get really offended when people say that I'm wasting myself doing this, because it's what I love and I get enjoyment out of it and I can support myself and I'm not bored. And what more would people want from me? And I think that we have to understand that if we're worried about what other people think, whether those are strangers, friends, or other relatives, if we're more worried about what other people think about what our child is doing than we are worried about how our child feels about how they're doing, then we've gone astray.
Yeah, that's a really good kind of test, isn't it? Good. That's a really good tip. Thank you. What have you got any other tips for us about how parents can manage perfectionism or help their children to manage perfectionism?
Yes, let's get more practical. Practical tip that I would suggest as the first thing would be to sit down and think about, and some of this will depend on the age of the child, but sit down with the child and list out a bunch of different areas in which the child is engaged. This would be the way that they manage their chores or responsibilities around the home, the way that they engage maybe in sport or any extracurricular activities that they're involved in, the way that they are in school, maybe even break that down to different subjects if they're getting older, the way that they are in relationship with themselves, their intrapersonal life, and then rate each of those areas on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being I'm a little too lax, I'm a little too comfortable with low performance than I should be, and a 5 being I'm such a perfectionist in this area that it's hampering me. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then plot that out and then look at each one and say, where's the desirable place to be on this scale? And so do I need to get more conscientious, not more perfectionistic, right? The scale would be totally laissez-faire all the way to over conscientiousness.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the
being
level?
Being just about right in the middle.
Well, it depends, right? Because like we mentioned in the insulin example earlier, in some areas, they may need to be what others would consider overly conscientious.
Okay. Yeah.
But then in other areas, maybe not so much. And so let them look at for each area, where are they? And do they need to move up or down the scale and by how much? And then understand that you're not going to go from a 5 to a 1 overnight. That these same habits that have been going on for years are going to take a long time to undo. And so we can't exacerbate the perfectionism by putting, this ultra perfect standard on there. Well, now you know where you are and where you should be and you need to fix it by tomorrow, right? We need to ease into these things and remind ourselves and then revisit that. Another tip I would say is to help kids set reasonable expectations of themselves we shouldn't leave our children alone. Even kids that are like 18 years old that are legal adults, they still need our guidance in setting reasonable expectations of themselves. Now, telling people how they should feel never works. You can't say that, but you can ask questions. You can say, I'm noticing that you are very disappointed because X happened. And I'm wondering if you can tell me where that disappointment stems from. Like, what news did that give you about yourself that was disappointing? And how would you have felt differently if it had turned out differently? We also, third thing is, we also need to make sure that our kids see us trying and failing. All of the adults around them only succeeding at stuff. If we, let's say we burn dinner, right? And so dad's cooking dinner, he burns it. And instead of everybody eating it, he just hides it and says, oh, we're going to go out to dinner. Instead of being honest with everybody and saying, dinner is burned. This was a hot mess. Or, you know, it looked good on Pinterest, but then it just didn't work out, right? We need to make sure that we're trying things in our own lives that are slightly outside of our comfort zone and our known ability to do them, so that our children see us fail in real ways, not fake ways, in real ways, and they see us handle that failure. They see us handle that failure in emotionally healthy ways.
I think that's brilliant. Yeah, I only this afternoon, I was driving my children to their swimming lesson, and my we were talking about something in the car, and I said to them, so they could both hear, you know, I just always want to get better and better and better. And it's like part of my life just to do that. And then we went off, we did some shopping and we went to the swimming lessons. And on the way home, my daughter had a brilliant swimming lesson. She was so excited about it. And she said, you know, it just makes me so happy to make improvements and get better and better all the time. And it was like, I don't know how consciously she was reflecting back what I'd said on the way, but I noticed it. And I thought, I've role modeled that to her. And I think, yeah, that kind of, it's growth mindset, isn't it? It's that desire to improve, but also to learn from mistakes, isn't it?
Yeah, and she wouldn't have had a good swimming lesson if she hadn't been willing to have bad ones in the past, right? Yeah. Like, you have to keep trying at things that are a little bit hard. I mean, so one suggestion I would make is that if I had a parent who, let's say we had a parent whose child was struggling with perfectionism in swimming, right, getting discouraged, then one of my suggestions would be that the parent needs to also be taking swimming lessons. Okay. Because then you would struggle. So whatever, if, as much as you can, be a guide alongside your child rather than the person standing on the sidelines telling them what to do.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. I can remember somebody else saying her daughter was having swimming lessons at quite an older age, kind of 10, 11, because she hadn't learned to swim before. And the mum got in the pool with her, and that was kind of the turning point. And yeah, I think if your child's struggling, what if your child's struggling with something that you can't go back to the beginning with, say with reading or with kind of essay writing or something like that, what would you suggest there?
You can still do things within that domain that would challenge you. So the example you gave was reading. Well, then maybe try reading War and Peace or read something that would be a challenge for you. Read something in translation, read peer-reviewed journals, read something in, you know, in your career field or something that interests you that's at a very high level, and sit with your child. The next thing I would say is that if it's something that, I'm trying to think of another example, is something that is hard to go back, because you're right, some things it's hard to pretend to be a novice, but like with swimming, you could try a stroke you never mastered, like the butterfly stroke. Many of us who are strong swimmers can't really do the butterfly stroke. So can you learn a different stroke? If there isn't an equivalent, if there isn't something that you can adjust to, then consider trying to learn something new where you can be a beginner in that and your child sees you being a beginner in that. And the two that I always suggest would be learning another language or playing a musical instrument. And let your child see that you are always trying to learn something new and you're willing to sound and look ridiculous while doing it.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a really good one. Yeah, I've just started learning Italian. I've made some flashcards for myself, and my daughter's always testing me on them, and she loves it because she actually knows it better than I do just from testing me, and she just loves that. So
yeah. And the thing is that now when she learns a world language, she'll remember that.
Yeah.
You know, she'll remember that. And, oh, my mom learned one too, and she sounded terrible for a long time, right? And then that develops their own self-patience.
Yeah, that's a great term, self-patience, patience with yourself. Yeah, I like that. Need a little bit more of that.
We all do. I mean, that's, I think, one of the reasons that the book has resonated with so many people is that in some area of our life, we almost all have an unreasonable standard for ourselves, right? And the more that we can be forgiving of that, understanding of that, the more that we can treat ourselves with the golden rule, right? Sometimes I think I hear that the golden rule, you know, that we should treat others as we want to be treated. I think we may need a higher standard because lots of us treat ourselves terribly.
Definitely. I was going to ask you actually, because I often think to myself, like people will say, oh, you're such a perfectionist. And I'm like, oh, I'm not a perfectionist. I get loads and loads of stuff wrong. And I can point out all the mistakes and all the things that are wrong. And I think I just need to be more of a perfectionist. What would you say to somebody who's got that going on in their head?
That they want to be more of a perfectionist?
Yeah, that they don't think they're enough of a perfectionist.
Well, some people aren't, right? Like, some people need a little more conscientiousness in their lives, but most people who are worried about it are not in that group.
Yeah.
So what I would say is, what is it that you think perfectionism would tell you about yourself that you don't already know? Like, if you could be more perfect in that area of your life, how would you feel? Like, what would you know about yourself that you don't know now? And would you feel somehow more worthy? Would you feel somehow more entitled to the things that you have in your life? Like, sometimes a desire to be more perfect in our lives arises from guilt that we don't really feel like we deserve the success that we have or the healthy relationships that we have. You know, like many times I think to myself, I don't know how I fooled this guy into marrying me because like I am so hard to live with. And I recently said to my husband, if I die, I want you to get married again, but I don't want you to marry somebody very nice. Because if you marry somebody really nice, you're going to be thinking, I could have been married to someone like this all along. Right. And so I think a lot of times that desire to be perfect comes from a lack within ourselves of a feeling of, unworthiness within ourselves. And so if we really feel like, oh, I wish I could just do this exactly right, oftentimes it comes from some kind of void that thing has no hope of filling. That void needs to be filled from within us. It won't come from an external thing. However, I will say this. There are things worth trying to do as well as they can be done. And most of us with children want to be the best possible parent. We would like to be the parent who leaves our child unscarred, right? Like that's our goal, that we want our child to be happy and to have a good relationship with us and to trust us. And, you know, we would literally give our lives for that child. And so we want to do this right. We know that we only get one chance. Even in those domains, we have to be honest with ourselves and realize that there are no perfect parents. And that all we can do is set reasonable expectations for ourselves in that, and then also find our children, other people in their lives who can also be guiding forces for them. And lots of people find this in their faith community or in friendships that are developed. And so we have to recognize that when we seek to be perfect, we are assuming that we have way more power than we really do. Because no matter how good you are, it will never be enough for a child to completely live off of. Nobody can live off of the power and strength of someone else. So if we are feeling too perfectionistic in our own lives or desire for it, we have to analyze, where is that desire coming from? Is it coming from the void that I mentioned? Is it coming from pridefulness? Is it really that we want to be perfect in this? Or is it that we do as what you describe, which is what Dan Goleman, the psychologist Dan Goleman, would call achievement drive, which is that I'm just always striving to attain a high level of performance. And I'm here, I'm at this level right now, and I would like to get to this level. And that's not unreasonable.
That's the pursuit of excellence, isn't it? That's like becoming a better athlete or moving to the next level in, you know, academia or athleticism or music or whatever. That's healthy, but actually wanting to get 100% on every test, that's not healthy.
Yes, and I have done that. You know, I tell a story in the book about when I was at university and I had a professor who told us on the first day of class he didn't give 100s. And I just wanted to quit the class.
Yeah.
Like, I was thinking, I'm going to make him give me a 100. And all semester, I got 99s. And at the end of the semester, when I went into his office and I asked him, why? Like, what's going on? And he said, you know, Lisa, I could have given you a 100 at the beginning of the semester, but your 99s at the end of the semester were so much better than your 99. Wait, your 99s at the end of the semester were so much better than your 99s at the beginning of the semester. And if I had given you 100 right away, you would have had nowhere to grow.
Yeah.
And I think that we don't realize how much we limit ourselves when we seek for the 100.
The word I want to use to describe that is beautiful, because that is almost the limit of the education system. And when we mark people and all that kind of thing, we limit the room for growth, don't we? And that's a tragedy, really. But when you can see that room for growth and you push yourself to achieve that kind of growth, it's such an incredible and amazing thing that you can achieve.
Well, one of the problems that we have is that lots of times our high ability students don't get very much feedback on the work that they do.
It's very good, or it's very excellent.
Yeah. Exactly. Smiley face in the United States, smiley face, a happy face. And the problem with that is that then they don't know what they did right.
Mm.
And so they feel like they have to do everything right next time because they don't know what they did that earned that.
Mm.
And so one of the things that teachers can do is to make sure that they give quality feedback even on very high scoring assignments.
Yeah, no, that's feedback I give to all the students that I work with, is actually learn how to analyze your own work so that you know what's good about it and you know what's bad about it and therefore what you can improve about it. Because only when you can look at it through the eyes of the person who's actually marking it, can you truly understand what you need to do in order to progress. And yeah, I mean, it starts with that feedback from the teacher, what's good, what's bad, and then you start to recognize those things yourself, don't you?
Yes, and it often takes a little bit of distance. So today, this morning, I created a landing page on my website for my book. Mm-hmm. And I'd never done anything like this before, and it took me several hours. And when I was done, I was, well, that's pretty good. And I sent my husband the link and told him to look at it. And he wrote me back and he had a couple questions about things. And I went back just like 2 hours after I'd done it and looked at it and thought, oh, I could make this look better and I could make that look better, but I needed a little distance.
Mm.
And I thought, I'm going to wait a week. I'm going to give myself a little distance from this and then I'm going to come back to it. So one of the things that students need to understand is that you may not have work created for you all of your life, but you will be creating work for yourself. And the higher your ability, the more likely that you will be the one setting the standard for yourself. And if you don't learn to do that self-analysis, if you don't learn to do the hard work of self-analysis, you will never grow, because there won't be any, there's nobody else to tell me how I'm doing on my own website, or, you know, I could hire somebody to do it, I guess. But if we can learn to be strong participants in our own feedback loop, then we empower ourselves to an incredible degree.
And I think there's something there about getting emotional distance from your own work as well, because I think often when we ask for feedback, and I can remember doing this as a student myself, my mum has an English degree and I'd give her my English essays to read, and I'd want her approval. That's why I was giving her the essay, because I'd want her approval. And so when she came back with criticisms, it made me angry, because that's not what I wanted. I was too emotionally attached, both to the quality of the work that I'd done and to the nature of the feedback. And I think put that emotional distance in place, that's really important as well, isn't it?
Yes. And they're in a book called The War of Art, which is come out,
I've heard of it, I haven't read it.
Fantastic. And in it, the author talks about the idea that the kind of identity politics surrounding our work, that we are not the work. That is not us. Like, we created it, we made it, but it doesn't represent us. It's not our avatar. Mm-hmm. That if you destroy the work, you destroy us. You know, we produced it, but that's not all there is to us. And we have to recognize that. We also have to be honest with people about what we want when we seek their feedback. If we only want to hear the good stuff, then we need to be honest with the person that we're giving it to.
And ourselves.
And ourselves, right? We have to be honest. Like, you know what? I'm not ready to hear any criticism of this yet. So just tell me what you like about it. I'll come back in a couple of weeks and you can tell me what I could do to make it better, right? Yeah. But for right now, I've given it like half of my blood and I need you to just tell me how great it is. And if we can be honest with ourselves and those around us about what we are looking for in our feedback, and then if we can slowly move ourselves into that separation of ourselves from the work, you know, then that's a much more emotionally healthy place to be.
Definitely. That very wise. And you're so well read as well.
Well, I too have an English degree.
Oh, brilliant. Fantastic. So are there any more distinct tips that you'd like to share with us today, Lisa?
One of the things that can really get perfectionists going is that they see themselves struggling with something in the moment and they forget that there are things that they do in the right now that used to be difficult for them and no longer are. Mm-hmm. So we get all caught up in how hard something is for us right now, and we forget if we keep working on this, pretty soon we'll feel about this thing the way that we feel about this other thing that used to be hard for us and no longer is. So when I work with kids, I ask them to make a timeline of skill development in different areas. So let's take your daughter and her swimming. So when she first started swimming, the first thing they have them do usually is like put their face in the water, like blow bubbles in the water. And I was like, swimming lessons around the world, I think, start with bubble blowing in the water, right? And at first that can seem scary to people. Right. And then they hold on to the kickboard and they learn how to go with kicks. And then eventually they add the arms and then eventually they get different strokes. And so if she writes like the progression of her skill in swimming, and, you know, at this point I could swim the length of the pool, right, without any help. And then what am I working on right now? Like, what is it that's my challenge I'm trying to learn right now? And then importantly, where am I going? Like, when I'm all done taking swimming lessons, what will I be able to do? Okay. So I'm doing this with myself right now because I'm really trying to improve my German. I used to live in Germany, and since I've left, I have forgotten almost all my German. In fact, just now I try to think of, I've forgotten almost all my German. Ich habe vergessen. No, that's not right. Ich habe, I can't even conjugate the verb anymore. And so I've started, and I had to do this exercise for myself. Like, well, when I first started in German, I said, you know, I learned how to greet people, and then I learned more words, and then I learned a past tense, although I still would go into the bakery and say schneiden bitte, which literally means to cut, like I want the bread cut. I didn't even know how to say it, right? I learned more conjugation, and now I'm struggling with more sophisticated vocabulary, and eventually what I want to be able to do is go back to Germany and speak nothing but German the whole time I'm there, right? So you need to see this timeline that includes a goal, that includes a goal. With piano, it would be the same thing, right? A musical instrument. With maths, it would be the same thing. Like, what do I eventually want to be able to do? And when you do that exercise, you see where you are on that timeline now, and you realize that at some point, you will be where you have been, and that whereas a child who's been taking swimming lessons for 3 years, if somebody says, I want you to go blow bubbles in the water, they're like, are you serious? It's so easy. fact is that there is no such thing as easy. You may have heard me say this on El Sheva's podcast, that there's no such thing as easy or hard. There's just familiar and unfamiliar. There are the things that we are comfortable doing and the things that we're not comfortable doing. And the very same thing that feels easy to one person doesn't necessarily feel easy to another, not because of ability, but because of practice.
Yes, it's so true. And what I say to my students is that you just have to keep pushing yourself a little way out of your comfort zone. And when you do that, you'll suddenly one day discover that you're comfortable where you once weren't comfortable. And then you'll be able to move on and move on and move on. And your skill or, you know, your ability will grow. And yeah, it's so true.
So we call that the zone of proximal development. So this is Csikszentmihalyi's work. The book Flow talks a lot about it. But the zone of proximal development is your zone of next development, because proximal is next. So your zone of next development is the ideal place to work. It's where it's your next level of skills. So it's not so hard that you get discouraged, and it's not so easy that you get bored. The problem is lots of high ability people are very comfortable working in their zone of current development. They don't want to work outside that little boundary. They don't want to work in the zone of proximal development because that feels hard. It feels uncomfortable. And yet, the research shows that that's where we actually get the most reward. That's what activates the reward centers of our brain. We get very little sense of satisfaction from achieving something that was easy for us. There's far more satisfaction and happiness to be found in challenging yourself a little bit.
Yes. It's so true. It's so true. I'm very interested in what you said there about people of high ability not wanting to challenge themselves. Is that because they're so accustomed to not being challenged? And I see that often in, you know, very high achieving students in schools, that it's just easy for them and it's not a challenge. And so they can't be bothered.
Yeah, it's hard to make people care about doing something that isn't really worthwhile to them, right? Imagine that you asked your 8-year-old to write the alphabet. That there would be no value to that in her. She would feel no sense of satisfaction if she did it. And so a lot of our high ability students linger like that for long years in school without really getting any sense of satisfaction out of the work that they're doing, because it's come to them very easily. And so they don't even expect to find any joy in the work. And then that becomes a habit. They just become habituated to it. It's one of the reasons it makes it hard to release animals that have been in like sanctuaries back out into the wild, because when you've handed them their food, they don't even have the desire to hunt, right? And they'll starve to death, even if food's right there, is because they're so used to having it handed to them. And it's the same thing with students. I think one of the other issues here, though, is that a lot of high ability people, they're so used to things being easy for them that when something is hard, something does take practice, something does take work and does take effort, they have this existential crisis.
Yes.
Like, oh, maybe I'm not really smart. Maybe I don't even belong in that university. Maybe I shouldn't even be in this class. And maybe I'm just a fake. We call that imposter syndrome.
That's what happens to so many people when they go to Oxford and Cambridge, because like when I was there, so many people have been easily the top of their school for years and years, like from the age of 4 to the age of 18. And then they get to Cambridge and everybody's as bright as them, if not more. And they're like, and they have to work and really try for the first time ever. And they don't know how to cope. They like question the fact that they're there. They, you know, it is an identity crisis.
Yeah. So one of the problems is that people will say, oh, he doesn't know how to study, or she doesn't know how to study. Like, she got all the way to Cambridge and doesn't really know how to study, and that's why she's not doing well. No, that's not the answer. Because if you have so much ability that you don't need to study, you can Google how to study and how to write note cards and have a study group and how to deep read. The problem is the emotional life, is that emotional conversation that they're having with themselves about whether they, like you said, deserve to be there. And so imposter syndrome affects all kinds of people. I mean, most of us feel it in some area or another. Like, I remember when I came home with my first child, I was like, I can't believe they're letting me bring this baby home from the hospital. I don't know what to do. Like, I don't know anything. Like, this is ridiculous. Like, they made me take a test to make sure I could drive, and they're just handing me a human. Like, so we all feel it in different areas. You know, my first year of teaching, oh, I just wish I could go back and write a letter of apology to every single student I had in my class, my first year teaching. So we all are going to have those feelings. The fact is that almost everybody there feels the same way. And the only people who don't are operating under a delusion, mm-hmm. right? Like everybody else feels the same way. And that's that big fish in a small pond syndrome. And it's really going to be most impactful for students who come from small rural communities. You come from a small village, you attended a village school. Okay, so these terminology is different in the US versus Britain, but
I think here what happens, like going back to my husband, but he went to a comprehensive in a large city with a very kind of diverse population, and he was the only one that went to Cambridge, and he'd found school so easy all the way through. And then he was suddenly at Cambridge amongst all these people who'd gone to really expensive schools and were so much more sophisticated than him and all this kind of thing. And that's when he started to question it. And I think in this country, it's often about what kind of school you went to and mm-hmm. whether it was a paid for school or a state school. And that's what really kind of undermines people's confidence.
Yeah. And the thing I would say to people is wherever you are, you belong there. Mm. And embrace the fact that Cambridge doesn't let people in because they want to make your grandmother happy.
They
let people in because they think you belong there. And they wouldn't have let you in if they didn't think that.
There's so many other people that could get in that are good enough that yes. they really wouldn't have you there if you weren't. Yeah.
That's right. And the same is true of lots of areas of our lives, right? Mm-hmm. But so if we can understand wherever I am, I belong there. I might have to fake it till I make it a little while, right? May not be as easy for me. Some people, and here is something, I think it's actually really an emotional thing. I think it's a social and emotional dynamic. Because the people who come from what I think there would be called public schools, like the exclusive private schools,
yes. yeah.
called public school. Okay, so like in the United States, the one we would have heard of is like Eton, right?
Yes, yeah.
They go to a school like that, and then they go to Cambridge. It's not that big of a leap for them because they're used to exclusivity. Mm-hmm. They're used to being somewhere where lots of people would like to go, but very few people actually get to go. And so then when they get to Cambridge, it's not that much of a jump. Like, oh, I've already been in an exclusive environment. Mm-hmm. Whereas for those of us who come from more typical environments and more diverse environments, we're not used to that. We're used to being places where whoever wants to be there can be there. Mm-hmm. And so we have a social and emotional adjustment into the place. Yeah. It has nothing really to do with our ability no. and everything to do with the social interaction that we're used to. And really the key there is to maintain your humanity in that environment.
Yeah, I think we should start winding up now, but I think that humanity, it echoes back to what we were saying earlier about values and making sure that your values are aligned with expectations and all that kind of thing. And I think that's a really important point, is it's finding the humanity in all of this perfection and achievement and all that kind of thing, and having the grace with yourself and with others just to be a human.
Absolutely. And that's a perfect way to wrap this up, although I could clearly just talk with you all day long.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today, Lisa. Where can people find you if they've been as fascinated with this conversation as I have and they'd like to follow up on it?
The easiest way to find me is at my website, giftedguru.com, and they can link to all my other social channels from there. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, and I have a YouTube channel, and they can find everything there. They can sign up for my newsletter. I send a newsletter out once a month, so if they're interested there. And if they have a specific question, they can email me at lisa@giftedguru.com.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on the School Success Formula today, Lisa.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. I really felt a strong connection to Lisa, and we clearly have so much in common with each other in terms of our interests in education. So I really hope that you got a lot out of that interview today. I'd love to know what you think of it. If you'd like to leave a comment at the bottom of today's show notes, which you'll find at lifemoreextraordinary.com/46, I'd really love to hear from you there. Or you can tweet me at Lucy C. Parsons, or if you're a member of my private Facebook group that's exclusively for parents of secondary school students, then please do leave a comment in over there. If you're not already a member, you can find it by searching on Facebook for Supportive Parents Successful Students with Lucy Parsons, or there's a link in today's show notes. So all it remains for me to say today is thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and goodbye.